It is Monday. Oof, God, what is the date? It's Monday, August 2nd. This is LA Podcast. I'm Scott Frazier here with Cerise Castle and Rachel Reyes, live from sunny Silver Lake. How are you doing this afternoon or morning? How are you both? I'm really not on my game this morning.
I'm doing good. You know, I have a lot of paranoia about the Delta variant that I'm dealing with. I have some travel coming up that's making me really anxious. And yeah, that's where I'm at.
Yeah, I actually have been going through the same thing. I was going to talk about for my LA story this morning, just the fact that we have had a lot of interaction with people in the past couple of weeks, after which we got, you know, negative COVID tests, at least I did. And then like we had more planned, just like summer activities. We're like, you know, in this transitional period where we're about to have a baby and know that we're not going to see people much in the coming months. But we had to cancel all of our plans because of Delta. And just like, I mean, we kind of talked about it on the show last week, but the transition from, well, the science doesn't really establish clearly that Delta is a threat for vaccinated people to, or that they can pass it to anybody who's unvaccinated, to this disease is as contagious as chickenpox, famously like a very, very contagious virus. And also like if you are vaccinated, you can still definitely pass it to others. Like that reporting came out on, I think, Friday. And just, yeah, I mean, a lot of people are now canceling their plans. Of course, Cerise, you're traveling for work. A lot of people still have to do that. It's kind of just a very touch and go period, it feels like.
Yeah, I mean, very anxiety inducing, at least for me. Anyway, I went out on Friday night to have outdoor drinks and I really had a lot of envy for the people I saw going to the club, the club, getting their drink on. I'm just like, oh my God, it looks so nice to be so
carefree
so and willingly ignorant. It looked nice, but I don't know.
Footloose.
I guess the alternative to that is like long COVID.
Yeah. Right. Footloose, fancy free, and COVID positive.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't ever want to get COVID.
I know, me neither. And that's sort of the thing where it's like just structuring your life in such a way. I mean, especially like knowing that you, as a vaccinated person, still have the ability to potentially infect somebody else and potentially infect somebody who doesn't really have the capability to fight off the disease on their own. It just like completely, for me and for my family, changes the calculus about what is something you should do and what is not safe to do. I mean, I guess shout out to LA Public Health for taking a relatively more guarded approach to this than a lot of other health departments throughout the state. It's kind of this thing where politically it became more expedient to open everything and wait until the science eventually found that things were much worse than we anticipated than to take the more cautious approach. But at least here we've been a little bit more fortunate in that the mask mandates came back sooner. Rachel, how was your week?
It was good. I had a little staycation, took a midsummer break.
Jealous of that.
Had a couple days off. No, it was lovely. It was lovely.
You told me in particular something that I loved, which was that you took 3 naps in one day. That's
I
how
did.
I staycation too.
I did.
Luxury.
And I want to say because I know a lot of people don't do naps.
Uh-huh.
I'm a big napper. And like I've been known to nap in my cars, at work, my car, singular car, on my lunch break. And I just love to nap. So I said to myself, you're not going to do anything. Sleep when you feel tired. And that is exactly what I did. And I feel very well rested.
Just like, you know, obeying your body's needs.
Isn't that funny? It's a lovely concept.
Your body will
to your
thank
body.
You for it.
It's so nice when we're able to do that. And it's so rare that
exactly.
we're able to.
This is the first time I've taken a break. Well, aside from last summer, which wasn't really a break, but taken a break during the summer and had a couple days off of work just because when you're in retail, like summer is sale time. Yeah. So you cannot, it's like blackout, sell. So I haven't had like any time off during the summer for like 6 years. So
having that opportunity to just be like, I'm taking downtime. And I mean, the whole concept of vacation day blackouts is awful anyway, right. But congrats. I feel like that's huge. That really sounds fantastic.
It was a win for sure.
Cerise, do you have an LA story?
I mean, my whole life is an LA story, Scott.
one chapter in the LA story that is your life.
Ooh. Oh, I have an LA story. I mean, this is more of an LA question. So this morning on my way here, I've noticed that there is a car parked in front of my patio that is like a street racing car.
Yeah.
It's yellow. It says fake taxi. The license plate says what GPA? It has like a bunch of like decals for different car clubs. It's super tricked out. And there is an inexplicable Blue Lives Matter flag on the back.
Huh. Interesting.
And yeah, it's my LA question because the police like hate those kind of cars. As far as I know, I mean, we have the Street Racing Task Force. We have like LAPD and LASD on their social media are constantly, you know, berating people for having events like that. And I'm just really confused by his Instagram's on the car too. 562 Justin, shout out to you. Maybe you can answer this LA question. Why do you love the cops when they hate you so much? That's
Justin,
I'm really perplexed.
From Downey, we have a question for you. I mean, also like though, that is the 562 area code. Right?
I was like, wow.
I mean, this is weird. I don't know. The fake taxi license plate, I feel like also is...
His license plate is what GPA?
Oh, what GPA?
He has a bumper sticker that says fake taxi.
Fake taxi.
I've been studying this car because it's just really... I have so many questions.
Okay.
Maybe the Blue Lives Matter sticker is like a diversion. Or like, you know, if you get pulled over, you're like, hey man, I got that on the back.
I'm a fascist.
Are we good?
Don't worry.
We're in this together. I also hate black people. Wow. So we have so much to go over this week. More happened than we could possibly talk about. Just a short, you know, before we get into things, a short little bit of housekeeping. We talked about in depth the trial of Ed Buck last week. And on Tuesday, a jury did find him guilty of all 9 federal charges that were brought against him, including 2 administrations of meth, resulting in the deaths of Timothy Dean and Jamel Moore in 2019 and 2017, respectively. He, I think, on all of those charges, faces cumulatively decades in prison, already elderly, safe to say he could very well spend the rest of his life in prison. He still also is facing, as we mentioned, a drugged-in charge from the district attorney's office, as well as civil suits, multiple wrongful death civil suits. Additionally, we have a new episode of our subscriber show, 30 Mile Zone, where we go through the canon of LA movies, and it is on the movie Annabelle. I had the good fortune to talk to Juliet Bennett Ryla, a horror enthusiast, and Allison Herman from The Ringer, who is not a horror enthusiast, but it was really fun to talk to them both, and that will be up on Wednesday. Let's get into the news for the week because, like I said, so much happened. We can't even talk about all of it. We want to get into one of the biggest things that happened, though, which is the LA City Council returned to session following their July recess, and the first order of business was finalizing a new version of 41.18. 41.18 is the municipal code that bans sitting, lying, and sleeping in public rights of way. It hadn't been enforced for quite some time because a federal court found it to be unconstitutional. That was a long time ago. And then there was a settlement that said that the city needed to provide more shelter. Mayor Garcetti said that they did that in 2018, and since then, the city council has been in the process of rewriting this ordinance. So this week, we have a new version of this law that is honestly bigger.
Worse?
Bigger and better than ever, right? Cerise, do you want to talk about what's in 4118 now?
Really bad things? I mean, yeah. I mean, I suppose I can. No, I shouldn't. You do it.
Okay, I can do it. Yeah.
Cut
I
mean, that out.
So the new version of 4118, like the existing version that was not enforceable, that was unconstitutional, said anytime in the city, anytime, anywhere in the city, it is illegal to sit down, lie down, or sleep on a public street, right of way, anything like that. And that was deemed to be a violation of civil rights because there was nowhere for unhoused people to go. The new version attempts to get around this, what the federal courts called a, and this was again in the, basically in the Bush era, I think it maybe was the very beginning of the Obama term when the settlement came down, but the federal courts said that this was criminalizing the state of being homeless. Mm-hmm. And city council members have pushed back really strongly on that with their new version of this bill saying that they're not criminalizing being homeless. They have created now a new system in the version of the ordinance that just passed with a 13-2 vote. Council members Mike Bonin and Nithya Raman, the lone dissenting votes of the 11th and 4th districts, respectively. And this new version, like I said, creates a system where council members can request for specific areas in their districts to be made off limits for sitting, lying, sleeping. Also, in addition to those, which that was the language of the old ordinance, they've added in maintaining, using personal property on these rights of way within these radiuses. So it's actually an expanded version of what you can't do in mm-hmm. each of these areas. But they're saying because it is not enforced as a blanket across the entire city, but rather has to go through a resolution process, that there is a check that means that only specific sensitive sites and specific, for example, ADA passage, things like that will be protected by this ordinance instead of it being the de facto enforcement across the city.
So you'll have to take special enforcement back to that board that passed this with flying colors.
Yeah, right.
If you want to criminalize some unhoused people.
Exactly. I mean, and the thing is, like, the closest, I think, at least as far as I can see, the closest analogy to this system that is being created, which, by the way, we still don't know, like, what committee is actually going to oversee these. Is it mm-hmm. going to be homelessness and poverty? Is it going to be public safety? I think it probably will, honestly, given the language that's in here about like danger to the public and things like that. It seems like they're trying very much to make this a public safety ordinance, which is interesting because it is at base, it was originally a loitering provision mm-hmm. in the municipal code. So they're trying to make...
Which is racist. Just loitering is just...
Right.
Like, that's just a racist law. Anytime you see any kind of loitering ordinance, that's racism.
Mm-hmm. I mean, okay. So, and how is it effectively racist? How is it implemented in racist ways? Because this is important, I think, to this discussion. This notion of loitering is, I mean, the homelessness criminalization that we see in LA does directly evolve out of these discussions of mm-hmm. who can be where at what times
yep.
in the city, right?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I didn't do a history recap before I got here, but I mean, I think if we look back as to like where these came up, like where loitering resolutions, laws, that sort of thing came up, it's policing where people of color can be at what times and when. You know, when I'm saying that, the thing that pops into my head is, of course, like sundown towns and mm-hmm. that sort of thing. You know, you're not allowed to be in this zone from this time to this time, and that growing and expanding, becoming more, I guess, like politically correct by evolving into loitering. I mean, we see loitering stuff, I think probably the most in Los Angeles, in like South LA. I see it in mm-hmm. East LA. you know, both places where there are high concentrations of Black and Latino people. And again, policing where they can be at what times. And this, I feel, is just an extension of that. I mean, most of the homeless people that we have in this city are, again, marginalized groups, Black people, mm-hmm. Latina people, mm-hmm. gay people, trans people. And here we are again saying you do not have permission to exist in this space.
I think that's such an important like aspect of this, because it's like, who has the right to be in space, to use space? Now we've actually expanded loitering to encompass, like I said earlier, maintaining, using personal property.
It's personal property. What like what counts property? As property?
We brought this up in our...
Are those personal property, those big rocks and planters y'all like to put?
I know, right? Like, you know, that is absolutely personal property. What is personal property, and who is going to actually get this ordinance enforced upon them? Like if I were to think back to when I were a high schooler, right? Like if I'm sitting out, so like let's say that under 4118, one of the things that can be done is you can get a restriction on sit, lie, sleep, maintaining or using of public property within, you know, a certain number of feet, 500 feet from a park. So if I were to go, let's say, outside of Echo Park, which is a place that has been a hotbed of concentration for anti-homelessness at the city level, if I were a teenager and I were out there with, let's say, my high school textbook, and I were sitting on the sidewalk, hanging out with friends, reading my textbook, I am violating this law. I'm doing something that's illegal. I'm sitting down and I'm using personal property on the public's right of way. So like the question of who is this actually going to be enforced against? Is it going to be enforced against like people who are clearly upper income that the police do not typically harass throughout the course of the day? Probably not. But is it an effective tool to target the groups that are subject to police harassment, including young Black and brown men in particular, including people who cops think give the appearance of being homelessness, mm-hmm. regardless of what their housing status actually is? Like this is, it seems like it dramatically increases the likelihood that police are going to have solid ground to harass people at any given time. Not that they necessarily need that, you know, like we're all aware that the power dynamic is such that they can kind of just do it anyway, but it seems like it gives them license to do that at will.
Well, it's everyone at this table, right? We'll be subject to harassment because of 4118. And I also think it's important to tie this to the Olympics that are meant to happen in 7 years, like because it stipulates specifically that it will be enforced for events where the city has issued a permit. Like the entire city will be hosting the Olympics, you know, from the Valley and also like all the way down to Long Beach, like, which obviously is not in our purview, but like the entire city will be affected by this and it will be enforced with more money at that time, with more LAPD officers at that time. And it's specifically to target Black and brown people. And like Scott and I were talking before we started recording, like, you know, unhoused people are not a protected class. And right. So it's like which they should be, but they're not. And so this is just like standard harassment. And who gets to harass people legally? It is the fucking cops. Can I say that word?
Yeah, please.
It's the cop. And so I think it is really important to, as Cerise said earlier, like with loitering, right? Just like, that is racist. This is racist. And it's important that we can like constantly bring that up, because I don't think that we can actually like have an honest conversation about what this will mean in practice without being honest about like what it actually is, which is racism.
I honestly, like, one of the things that I keep coming back to too is that notion of how is enforcement actually going to be carried out? Mm-hmm. And that was why we were talking about the notion of protected classes, where you could actually say, I mean, for example, you couldn't write a law. And you could write whatever you want and pass it into law, but it wouldn't be enforceable if you were to say, for example, this law only applies to Black people.
Right.
Or if the court was able to demonstrate that a law was only effectively being enforced against Black people. But that is because there is a protected class mm-hmm. implicated there. And the thing that the city of LA has done, which is incredibly pernicious, I think, is they are targeting an unprotected group of people mm-hmm. who are disproportionately, like, the Thank whatever, you. What, 5 or so times the actual proportional levels of Black people in Los Angeles are represented in the unhoused population. Mm-hmm. So they've targeted a group that is composed of all of these super marginalized individuals who have been failed by multiple systems and just fallen through the barely existent social safety net here. But they've done it in such a way that they can target them more easily for harassment. I mean, and again, mm-hmm. this isn't the first time they've done it. This right. has been found unconstitutional by multiple federal courts.
But Mark Ridley Thomas said, I have a new way to criminalize my people, and you are not going to stop me. I got Jeffrey Katzenberg, for Christ's sake. Oh, screw you, K-Town, for all.
The Katzenberg thing is still, I mean, so besides that one article that came out, right? It's still so perplexing to me. Like, that is what turns city council on a dime.
Shrek is a great movie, Scott. Have you seen Shrek? It's all about rich people being able to do whatever they want.
You know what is really funny? Like, Shrek has that line about, like, onions having layers or whatever. And I such a non sequitur. I was just reading something that had like a more full version about the like onions having layers thing. It's like onions have 5,000 layers, but each layer is still an onion. It's like the opposite meaning. So anyway,
look, onions are great.
I don't want there to be anything yeah. besides onion in an onion. I'm not saying that. But yeah, no. So Jeffrey Katzenberg comes down from atop the mountain and he says, I don't want to see this homelessness anymore.
And another crucial point here, homeboy isn't from LA.
No.
What's with all these? And I love that mm-hmm. like law enforcement loves to be like, the homeless people aren't from LA. What's with all these?
That's a good point.
Mm-hmm. What's with all these transplants coming in and dictating how we run the city? Mm-hmm. Go back to and where you came like. From, Jeffrey.
It's wild because it seems like that came out of nowhere. Like all of these meetings happened in the span of a couple of weeks. And then it was like, okay, Mark Ridley Thomas agrees that we need to rewrite this ordinance now. This thing had been sitting undiscussed for 6 or so months ever since activists, which, you know, the city council loves saying are not representative of public sentiment at large, but they did shelve 4118 the last time it came up due to pressure from those groups. So I don't know. It seems like they were just waiting for somebody who had a lot of power to tell them how he thinks they should be doing their jobs, more or less.
And so why do we think it was brought up again? Why do we think it was passed through so quickly, right? Like, it's still unconstitutional. It will probably still be found unconstitutional. So why do we think...
Has anyone taken a look at donations?
Right. Donations data, I mean...
There's a mayor race coming up. I mean...
Mm-hmm. There is a mayoral...
looked at those coffers?
I think that people will be scrutinizing that really closely, but the donations are maybe available for like if they actually happened in the last 6 month period, but otherwise we might not know for several months what those look like. It absolutely stands to reason that these folks are banking on a lot of high dollar support from, you know, from people who are deep pocketed. Jeffrey Katzenberg, of course, very, very rich, could buy and sell all of us a million times and is possibly doing that.
He loves to start things and then not follow through and cancel them, right? Could be anyone.
So, I mean, I actually want to go back to something that you said, Rachel, like as far as the unconstitutionality of or possible unconstitutionality of 4118, it is so interesting because like this is a particular case where these types of actions have directly been found to be unconstitutional, and not just unconstitutional, but actually violations of multiple different amendments under the Bill of Rights. It's like, it's something that continually gets shot down. I feel like the most cynical take on this, is that the politicians might not even think that this could hold up in court, but really are just putting it in place because they know that it buys them probably a couple of years before it actually gets to the point that a judge shoots it down yet again.
And it literally buys them extra terms.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Possibly a promotion in the form of mayor.
Right. Literally just, you know, taking the view of the people who are living on the streets as collateral damage for their ability to get enough votes to stay in office, which they are potentially viewing as something that they would be able to do if they are able to just, again, like everybody seems to agree, or at least they did a year and a half ago, all of these politicians agreed that sweeping unhoused people from place to place was not the same as providing them services or helping them out of homelessness. Now, all of those same people seem to be more comfortable with the idea of just displacing people. And hopefully that will buy them time, buy them promotions, et cetera. And they'll be able to just, you know, make short-term gain for themselves at the expense of literally tens of thousands of people who are living on the street.
And during a surge, during the Delta surge specifically, it's deadly. Like, this is violence to... It's just like the next level of violence, because this would be violent no matter what. But during a pandemic, which we're still experiencing, we talked about COVID earlier being as contagious as chickenpox. These folks have nowhere to go.
CDC guidelines haven't changed.
Exactly.
They're now recommending that you wear masks, but they have not mandated it. They're recommending you wear masks indoors in public places.
I mean, as far as displacing unhoused people.
Oh, yes.
That has not changed. Right. Like that, we are operating against CDC guidelines now. Like that's, as Rachel said, this will kill people.
This is so interesting too, because it's like there is a mentality that thinks that just because the state of California reopened, or just because all of these other places across the country are reopening, you know, the pandemic is over. And that has like really...
I wish.
Right?
I wish it were so simple.
It has really like far ranging... Like I always go back to like the beginning of the pandemic, and there were all these concerns like Project Room Key exists, you know, flaws and all. It exists because people were looking at unhoused people as, in this kind of fucked up way, as vectors for transmission of COVID. And then, I mean, and also, of course, they were saying, you know, we want to protect them from getting ill and dying as well. And despite that, one of the things that came out of the earlier stage of the pandemic, they were like, oh, wow, there's not as much transmission among unhoused people as we thought there was going to be. So there's like not really a need to expand Project Room Key further.
So fuck 'em.
Yeah, basically yes. That was basically it. But then the thing that is weird is like there's not any re-examination or reconsideration of that now that we're dealing with the Delta variant, which is, you know, three times as contagious as before, which is possibly exactly as deadly as the original virus, or if not more so. Now, you don't hear politicians talking about transmission among the unhoused population. And I mean, actually quite the opposite. We had the council president of the city council, Nuri Martinez of the 6th district, saying that they didn't want to reestablish hygiene stations, which had again been put out because of the need to help unhoused people reduce their risk of contracting or spreading COVID. Council President Martinez said that that was a normalization of people living in encampments. Again, we're still...
give them basic human rights, Scott. They might, I don't know, treated like people.
It's an enticement to like... that's the thing is like... It's being talked about as like an enticement to bad behavior. Like it's like
it's so stupid. I've been homeless. Like it's so stupid. It's so like if I had had access to a bathroom when I was living in my car, like that wouldn't I fucking hated living in my car.
Right.
Like, having a bathroom wasn't going to keep me there. You know? Like, it's so stupid.
It's unfathomable. And the fact that, like, we have repeatedly had people come to this city, like, UN observers who are like, LA, I mean, if only the UN had any, like, leverage to make the United States or its component parts do anything, but... Like a UN representative coming here and saying that it was like among the Skid Row was among the worst conditions that he had seen anywhere in the world, and like the most violative conditions overseen by a government that he's seen almost anywhere in the world. It's like the fact that the response to that by the second or possibly first highest ranking official in the city is that it's a normalization of homelessness to provide hygienic conditions for the tens of thousands of people. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, running water. Can't do that. It's disgusting. And, go ahead.
Well, and just to talk about, like, Nuri talking about normalization, it's just really rich considering she was on Keeping Up with the Kardashians years ago.
Right.
Giving Kim a tour, a poverty tour of San Fernando, of an encampment by where my parents live. That encampment is not there anymore. But, you know, we have normalized rents being so high that people can't afford them. Rents being so high that people are evicted. We've normalized that for decades. Like, that is normal.
Yeah.
But what's not normal is providing basic rights to people who need them the most. Like, I'm like getting really upset because it's so unbelievable to me that someone like Nuri Martinez grew up in LA at the time that she did, along with my parents, where, you know, Mexican people were not allowed to do a lot of things. And the same rhetoric that we're using for unhoused people, we used in this city against Black and Brown people. Yeah. And just the, you know, I don't know. I'm like trying to calm
That's
down.
Real.
It's upsetting. Like, it's really upsetting.
I'm thinking of that map of 4118 and those little red circles. And as you said that, I was thinking of the red circles that I was looking at a few months ago for housing covenants.
Right.
Yeah. Determining where, you know, people like our families, all of our families could and couldn't live in this city.
It's honestly, I think it's a pretty devastating turn of events. One of the other things, just to close, that 4118 does. So Mark Ridley Thomas, the original author of this motion, for his part has said that he doesn't want to have any violation of this lead to folks going back into the prison system. However, he did amend the original written version of this, so that now it contains a provision actually making it a crime rather than just an infraction to willfully delay or obstruct any city official who is enforcing the provisions of this. So not only does it make it a crime, for example, to refuse to leave when you've been asked to do so by the police or by city sanitation or by whomever, but also it makes it a crime to be, for example, I personally, when I talked about this with Lexis Olivier Ray from LA Taco, we had very similar experiences at the exact same encampment on Coronado by the 101 freeway, where, I mean, Lex had the police actually called on him. I was just like roundly yelled at and thrown out of the area by LA City sanitation workers. Under this, both of us would be guilty of a crime, a misdemeanor, if not a felony.
Another huge, like, fuck you to our, like, constitution, essentially. Mm-hmm. Lex is a journalist. Like, he has every right, as are you.
Yeah.
We have every right to be there, to document. And, yeah, MRT is just, like, taking a real nice shit on people's civil
Amendment.
Rights, the First Amendment. Yeah. I think he's really hoping those Katzenberg bucks will boost him to mayor. What a scary fucking situation that would be.
And the alternatives to date, I mean, we're talking about
Joey buckets of shit. I'm just really swearing up a storm.
Council District 15, South LA and the Port, and then also Mike. City Attorney Mike Feuer. All three of these individuals are heavily invested in this exact model. Mike Feuer is trying to bring Lex up on charges as we speak.
Right.
So they're all invested kind of in the same model. There's not a ton of variety there. Hopefully that changes as time goes on, but we don't really have a ton of hope of that happening as far as I can tell.
Yeah, it probably won't. Like, I'll just go ahead and say that. It won't change. It will get worse.
I think that's just the field at this point. We want to talk about something else that's happening, which is about the wage theft that was announced in the El Super grocery store chain. Rachel, what happened there?
Yeah, so a few weeks ago, I was on talking about Kroger, how they're a hot mess, all of the bad things that they did. And El Super was also doing bad things for months. That kind of just came to light. So the Labor Commissioner's Office cited three different El Super stores, like in the LA area, one on Slauson, one in Linwood, and one in Victorville, for not providing the state's COVID-19 supplemental paid sick leave to 95 employees. So these three citations were about $447,000. And according to the
That's a huge, like, just like to say
half a million dollars.
That's a huge amount of money relative to what, like, I imagine what an employee at El Super makes. Like, these are substantial violations.
That seems like, especially in a pandemic, like, that could be life-changing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
$500,000 from 100 employees. Like, they're stealing thousands of dollars from each of these people. And that's like a significant portion probably of their overall annual salary. This is something that means a lot to these families.
And I haven't read anything because I was wondering, like, did any of these people die? Because they were, you know, according to the Labor Commissioner's Office, they were forced to work while sick. Some were told to just apply for unemployment while they were isolating or quarantining. But also some folks waited for months to actually be paid out their supplemental sick leave. And the first two points are why this law was passed, right? So that folks, if they got sick, they could stay home to take care of themselves or their family members. But also if they were exposed and needed to be isolated, exposed at work, specifically that they could stay home and still get paid. And so these are the first citations that I've seen. I don't know if there were some previously, but this is certainly the biggest one that I've seen in the pandemic era. And obviously, right, like this matters because these folks are people, but also because, like, this is that gray area between public and worker health that I'm constantly talking about. Because when you're at work, you are governed by Cal OSHA. Like, that's the health and safety you got to follow. But the second you clock out and go home, you're part of the public. And so, like, if you are exposed at work, you're going to bring that back to your communities, to your neighborhoods, to your families. So this doesn't just impact those 95 people, right? Like, this impacts their families, their neighbors, the people that they interact with at the bank, at the mall. So this is actually huge.
Yeah, I mean, when we talk about, like, community spread of COVID, and this was something that, I mean, it's been characteristic of our conversations over the course of the past year plus at this point. We've talked a lot about this virus, which now at multiple different points has been raging in East and South Los Angeles and in the North County at points in time when on the West Side, things have been relatively speaking in more control. And it's like, when you extend this story out, like when you have low income workers in a variety of situations where they're being forced, they're being compelled to work when they should be able to be paid to be at home. And then they're going and doing the things that they need to do to survive in their communities. Of course, it seems like you would have these out of control spreads happening in places where low income workers are living, where they live and where they have friends and family, because it seems like minimal protection. These violations occurred over a period of months or longer, right?
Right. I think workers filed wage theft claims, I want to say in September of last year. So this was last fall. So I would imagine that all of these wage theft claims were coming from last summer, prior to September of 2020. So almost, exactly a year ago, probably. And like, what do these workers look like? You know, these are black and brown people. Yeah. And we know that black and brown folks were disproportionately affected by COVID infections because of the jobs that they're working. And obviously this includes grocery stores, And this policy, there was a federal version of it last year that expired at the end of the year in December. And so the state, we passed our own, the California version. And the whole point of it is to provide 80 hours of pay to folks if they're exposed, if they need to isolate, if their family member is exposed and needs to be taken care of, but also for vaccine-related needs. That's written into the California law because part of stopping the spread, obviously we talk about masks, but it's also getting vaccinated. And so in our law, specifically relates to vaccines. If you need time off, if you can't find an appointment outside of work, you can get an appointment during what might be your shift. And your boss cannot retaliate against you. Anti-retaliation is also written into this law. So workers can use this time to go get their first shot if they're getting a two-dose vaccine, but also after their second dose, if they feel a little sick, which I definitely did, I had to take three
you
days off.
Will.
Yeah.
Right. Took me out.
Yeah, it knocks you out. You don't feel great. So you can utilize this time because a lot of workers, again, don't get, they might not get sick pay. They might have already used it all. They might not get PTO. So they otherwise would not have an opportunity probably to get this vaccine or to take care of themselves if they get sick. And so we've heard so many stories about workers who wanted to take time off, but were really worried about those second shot side effects that a lot of workers have just delayed taking the vaccine, but they have this time. And so, yeah, the state, I don't think, has done a good enough job at communicating to workers that this is statewide. You have 80 hours. You cannot be fired for
I feel like it is. I mean, so much we've been talking about is about communication and how the government actually reaches people and lets them know what their rights are. I also, though, I have to think, I'm thinking about like, so the time off for vaccination and stuff like that, it's similar to, you know, provisions that say that your employer has to give you time, paid time to go vote, right? Like we don't make it on a weekend or a holiday here, but technically you are supposed to get paid time to go vote. Mm-hmm. And I feel like similarly, even if people know about that, there are a lot of folks, especially who are on the lower end of the income scale, who are hesitant to use that. And that's for a variety of reasons. I mean, of course, in voting and maybe also in vaccination, there's a perceived limited applicability. Like there are some people who think I'm young, I don't need to get vaccinated or whatever. And hopefully some of that sentiment is changing. But I also think that some of it is the perception earned in many cases that the anti-retaliation aspect of this is not strong enough to actually protect them. You know,
right.
like there's a law and there are words to the effect that your employer can't take punitive action against you for doing something that's in your interest. In this case, staying home if you're sick or going to get vaccinated or anything like that. But there's like we're seeing, you know, enforcement is sort of like a lagging thing. Your employer can do whatever they want to you in the meantime. And there are a lot that operate sort of in a predatory way against their employees. And I feel like a lot of people just feel like it's a gamble that I can't take you know, what?
Especially when you have a law enforcement agency that goes on a national media tour saying that they will selectively enforce laws as they see fit. It doesn't really inspire a lot of confidence that the government has your back should you face retaliation.
Yeah. I mean, let's talk about that because the sheriff's department plays a role here, right?
Yeah. So thank you for bringing that up, Cerise, because I just learned this recently. As we all know, Sheriff Villanueva said that him and, you know, the rest of the sheriffs would not be enforcing the mask mandate that the county brought back on July 18th.
He said the Department of Public Health could enforce it themselves if they wanted to.
Yes, but the sheriffs, LASD, they're the ones in charge of enforcing public health, but also of enforcing wage theft, which I just learned. I did not realize that, but LASD is in charge of enforcing wage theft claims. And so what is wage theft? I think it is important to kind of just tease that out a little bit. Obviously, as it relates to El Super, that is wage theft. Folks were not paid for the time that they took off that they are legally entitled to. But wage theft can also look
like... Also potentially had to work for hours that they should have been paid not to
work. Exactly. So that counts if, you know, Scott, you're on your 15-minute break, you work at the mall, you're in the stock room, and then your boss comes up to your manager or a coworker and starts asking you questions about stuff. That's wage theft. Mm-hmm. Like, you're paid to take that break. But wage theft is also you clock out, Cerise, you're on your way out, and someone's like, can you just take this trash out? That's wage theft.
What happens too in the garment industry as exists yes. here in Los Angeles really frequently, and also the restaurant industry, is mm-hmm. folks are paid below minimum wage, which yeah. is also wage theft.
Yeah. And my last store, actually, when I took over that store and I was going through my payroll, I noticed that two of my employees were actually being paid below Santa Monica minimum wage.
Oh, my God.
And had been for months because they had been employed for about 2 or 3 months before I started. So that was a whole thing to try to get reversed because they had to get retroactive pay. So yeah, and they didn't know. Like, these two workers didn't know. So a lot of people don't even know that these things are happening. But if you did and you filed a claim with the DLSE, which is the Division of Labor Standards, same thing as the Labor Commissioner's Office, here in LA, like, it's the sheriffs that are supposed to be enforcing these things. And obviously,
so like if it were me and I were working at El Super and I had been forced to work instead of being able to take paid time off while I thought I had COVID or was quarantining, then the way that this is supposed to work is I would call the sheriff's department to report that this had happened. Is that right?
So no, you file a claim
okay.
with the DLSE, and then I believe that gets, because depending on where you are, yeah. So it would get routed here in LA, I guess. I've never had to deal with this myself. When it happened to my employees, I just called HR because I'm a manager that cares. But if you are a worker and your manager doesn't care if you've brought it up, but a lot of people don't because they're afraid to, obviously, then I'm imagining it gets rerouted to the sheriff's department.
For follow-up wow. investigation.
For a follow-up, which, like, I guess it just dies there is what's happening. But yeah, technically, sorry, excuse the pun, but technically, yeah, LESD is in charge of wage theft and this kind of enforcement, which is wild.
Do we think that this is more widespread than just El Super? Like, is it reasonable to expect that more of these claims might be coming?
So this is my question. I don't have insider knowledge, but I would hope that workers have banded together and, like, filed claims the way that these workers did, because I'm sure that this has happened all over, especially with our essential workers who were forced to go into work, were not given time off. I know of a lot of stores that were operating on, like, skeleton staff because so many people were out mm-hmm. sick. So it would not surprise me if we started to see more of these coming down the pipeline for the rest of the year. I mean, I would hope so. I mean, I know that the Labor Commissioner's Office is dedicated to bringing these kinds of cases to light to really, I mean, obviously they had a whole news release about this. So I think they are communicating to employers, like, we are enforcing this. And I think that that is super important, but it would not surprise me if like more of these cases started to be.
So from wage theft in grocery stores, we're going to go look at another retail situation. Now we're going to be talking about downtown Crenshaw Rising, the proposed acquisition of the Crenshaw Mall by a group, Downtown Crenshaw Rising, that would keep it, transfer it for the first time to Black ownership within a Black community that is trying to remain Black.
Isn't that cuckoo that, you know, Crenshaw has been, like, the home of Black Los Angeles since ever?
Yeah.
And the mall, which is, like, probably one of the first things I think of when I think of that district, yeah. has never been owned by Black people.
Yeah.
America, man.
It's a wild state of affairs. And it's kind of funny because you have, it's like, to go through the history of this location is sort of to transfer or to transition through these different stages in the history of LA, where it's like, okay, we're going to operate this commercial outpost in a place where none of our white shoppers would go. And also it's a way of containing Black commerce away from mm-hmm. white Los Angeles. To now, like, I mean, the current state of things is one in which gentrification is a really prevalent force here. Over the course of the past 40 years, it's led to the breakup of a lot of formerly Black communities in Los Angeles, which it's like there has just been a wholesale disruption in the fabric of a lot of these communities where a lot of folks are either forced out by rising prices or their families are forced to look for jobs elsewhere, or they go into the prison system, or they lose family members to the low quality social safety net that exists here. So we had a proposal from this group to actually buy as a community this mall as a community asset. They put forward the highest bid for this property.
Yeah, most money.
And it was turned down. Why? And in
racism. I mean, we know why. We know why.
Yeah.
And it's still bullshit.
It's like there's not really, I mean, the thing that stands out here to me is Downtown Crenshaw Rising, this group led by Damian Goodman, who's a prominent civic activist in Crenshaw and somebody who has fought against gentrification in the area for a long time, was a big part of the reason why the still not open Crenshaw, Metro Crenshaw line has a stop that's going to be right outside this mall, right outside that location. They fought really hard to put the other competitive bids for this into a stark light. So one of them was a company called Live Work that was associated with Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Another of them was for CIM Group, who have a lot of properties throughout, including one at La Cienega and Expo that's come under fire for being extremely expensive market rate housing. The interesting thing to me, or what stands out potentially here, is that you have the existing owners of related to Deutsche Bank, the existing owners possibly just wanting to stick it to Downtown Crenshaw Rising and this community for exercising power over who they were able to sell this to. And they just were like, oh, we're not going to just listen to you. We're not going to, we don't even want your money. I mean, that's
$115 million, by the way.
We would rather sell it for less to someone else, just to give you the finger.
Less, just so we can maintain control of your little neighborhood.
It's kind of like, I mean,
and get rid of you.
It's almost too on the nose. Like, your money is no good here. Like,
right. Yeah. Right. I mean, how is that legal? Like, that's my question, right? Like, I mean, I guess like the free market, whatever, blasé scribbly, but like, that's like racism right there. Like, you have a Black group coming with more money and it's no good here.
And they don't have to really provide any
explanation like that. Like, how is that allowed? I don't know. I'm not a banker, but that seems incredibly fucked up.
It's a remarkable example, as it seems, of the system protecting its own. Like, are you going to allow this asset to transfer into the hands of a community that has been very vocal about wanting to establish a space for their own merchants, for their own consumers, etc., such as they are today, versus the connections that a group like Deutsche Bank has with the eventual now purchasers, Heritage Group, who are known for coming in and building upscale developments in, you know, in gentrifying areas. This is to me, it seems like the system protecting itself from what could potentially be a successful model of transferring things to community ownership. It's like the additional money does not benefit them as much as denying the opportunity for them to show that this model could work.
Right.
And this mall also employs a lot of people who live in the area. So I used to work for Michael Kors in their retail division, which means that we worked for Michael, but inside of Macy's in Bloomingdale's. So this particular Macy's was one of the top doors in the district. And it was also one of the doors that was like my stretch doors. So I would go like once or twice a month to this location. And it was extremely busy. Mostly everyone that I worked with walked to work or took the bus. So it employs the community around it. And I think that's also really important to point out because like, where are all of these people going to go? There's a ton of stores.
They're
going to
lose their houses and be homeless and then end up in jail.
Yes.
Thanks to the city council member of the area.
Right. You know, and
and there's like a literal museum of African American art.
In the mall.
In the mall.
In the mall. What's going to happen to that?
They're going to get their rent raised. They're going to get their rent raised. And I'm sure that that, I mean, like they've already, you know, all of these stores have been going through the pandemic like everyone else. They've been forced to try and make things work however they can. The company that's coming in that will be doing the redevelopment, it's, I think, fairly likely that they are not going to be inclined to. It's like the same as when you have a new owner. Well, it's a little bit different, but it's similar to when you have a new owner come into a building that you live in. It's happened to me multiple times. They want to be able to brand the building in whatever way is most in line with their own corporate aesthetic, whatever is in, going to be most beneficial for their long-term profits. Normally, that means they want nothing to do with whoever is already there. So it's again, it's setting a stage for a pretty severe loss. I think, you know, Downtown Crenshaw Rising, for their part, have said the battle's not over just because they've announced that they're awarding this deal and they have been in this position before. So they're
gonna... And they kept the fight going, like, to their credit. Like, one thing about Downtown Crenshaw and I think that neighborhood in general is that they don't, you know, they don't back down from a fight, and this doesn't mean it's over. You know,
it's very similar to Boyle Heights. You know, and I think a lot about the Defend Boyle Heights anti-gentrification activism. There are some clear similarities, I think, especially as, you know, Boyle Heights, with the experience of Echo Park and many other Latino neighborhoods throughout the city, and Crenshaw with almost any other Black neighborhood that you can think of, have seen that there are plenty of examples of what happens when you're not willing to go to the mat to protect the fabric of your neighborhood from investment capital and its stalking horses. I do have to point out every time this mall comes up on the show, I have to give a shout out to the Macy's at the Crenshaw Mall for when I was unemployed during the Great Recession, declining to give me a job for wearing my hair natural, my natural Black hair.
Oh, yeah. No.
That checks out.
Which is now illegal.
Crown Act.
Which, of course, does not mean that it won't still happen. But yeah, shout out to you guys.
I'm so sorry to hear that. That Macy's, maybe it's probably new management, but every time they would open, they would clap in the like first couple of guests shopping. And they had like dance music on. And so we used to like clap people as they came in. Anyway,
it's all
I'm sorry,
good. I made it. I'm all right. I made it. Watch out, Macy's. All right. Lastly today, you know, we're so grateful that Cerise is here with us. We've been wanting to talk about a new story that you have up on Knock. This is a continuing saga. I mean, well, continuing saga. It's been going on for what, half a century now. We're talking about the LA Sheriff's Department gangs. There is new information coming out of the ACLU's lawsuit against the county and like every conceivable, what, like 50 defendants from the LA County Sheriff's Department. And they just released a
68
defendants in a claim, a very wide-ranging claim and investigation into the culture of deputy gangs at East LA Station. What is happening here?
Yeah, there's
that's
a lot
the question,
happening.
Right?
There's so much happening at East LA Station. It's hard to keep up with. So essentially, what happened was there was a new court filing, which was an amended complaint. In this case, where a group of whistleblower deputies have come forward to discuss all of the illegal things that are going on at the East LA Station under the purview of the Bandidos gang. And in this new amended filing, they have unmasked 68 of the 100 Doe defendants. And these 68 defendants range from deputies all the way up to command staff. So there are people throughout levels of management of LASD that are now implicated of being associates of some kind with the Bandidos gang. And they're still running shit is the takeaway.
What is the distinction made between, I think that this is the actual organization of this gang, of the Bandidos, is important to contextualizing what's actually happening within East LA Station, but it's also a little bit hard to parse, I feel like, for somebody who's not as familiar with it as you are. What is the distinction made between, they talk about members, they talk about associates, like what are the different levels of involvement with Bandidos?
Yeah, so this is kind of like a slash, this is like street history slash California Penal Code to get into this. So generally speaking, to be the member of a gang, you need to become a member, you need to put in work, which is, you know, doing things in order to further the scope of the gang, the power of the gang. And once you become a member, you generally get a tattoo.
Mm-hmm.
No different in deputy gangs. Generally, when we're talking about associations for gangs, when we look at things like CalGang, which is the enormous database that is maintained by law enforcement throughout California that adds people, that puts people into it to say that you are affiliated with a gang in some sort. It really doesn't take much to be an associate of a gang. I'm probably an associate of a gang just by the virtue of knowing people that are in a gang. That makes me an associate, right? Same thing with deputy gangs. When I talk about associates, I include people that have knowledge of the gang and very intentionally turn their back on what was going on and allowed it to continue. I think that makes you an associate. If you know about something that's going on and you're a law enforcement officer tasked with enforcing the law and you choose not to enforce the law, you're an associate of that gang.
In this case, it also includes, I mean, so we're talking about public officials or public employees who have, like you're saying, knowledge of the Bandidos and their operating and are in some cases ineligible for membership, like inked membership, right?
Correct.
And that's women, blacks,
black people.
I mean, two pointed omissions, but
yes, it's generally women and black people. These gangs are very progressive, as you can
I mean, so you have been following Alex Villanueva's weekly press conferences and everything.
Unfortunately.
Are those
the ones on IG Live or are those different?
Those, yes. Once a week, our sheriff gets on Facebook and Instagram Live and pretty much just rants for a good 30 minutes.
They should have to have like a Prop 68 warning of like, this press conference will cause cancer, known to the state of California to cause cancer. But one of the things that I found interesting, because like you're saying that there is such an overlap, I mean, it seems almost indistinguishable from the operating structures of street gangs as they're known so far and wide throughout American culture. And people, I think, are intimately familiar with this kind of structure just from movies, film, daily life. And yet, Alex Villanueva, the sheriff, made a really interesting distinction, I think, in one of these press conferences that I'm curious what your take on is. When he said that he like corrected somebody that he was speaking to about the use of the word deputy gangs and said that they were cliques and there are no gangs. What is the distinction being made there?
I couldn't tell you, Scott. Yeah, I mean, I think that's...
Aren't they just synonyms? Like,
well, I really don't think you could say a clique is a gang. A clique is, you know, the group of mean girls at high school that won't let you sit with them because you're not wearing pink on Wednesday. A gang is, you know, California Penal Code defines as a group of three or more with common hand sign or tattoo that are committing a wide range of crimes under the California Penal Code. The mean girls at high school aren't, you know, pressuring people to give them money, aren't, you know, killing people in the street.
But another common usage of click, though, is like if you were just to think about like the structure of like the Crips or the Bloods, like you have clicks underneath that don't even necessarily like one another, but like represent a certain neighborhood level affiliation. Like
I think that would be a set, my dear.
Is that?
That's a set.
Okay. I don't think it's like synonyms. That's a set.
It's not a clique. Like okay. A clique, I think, is a very much like a group of like, and even group is kind of like tenuous. A clique is, it's not a criminal enterprise.
Right.
A clique is a social group. I think it's closer to a fraternity, which is another thing that Villanueva likes to say these things are, like social clubs, fraternities. Again, social clubs and fraternities do not commit, frats do commit crimes, but it's not in their bylaws, say, to commit a crime.
Sure.
If I join Alpha Kappa, whatever the fuck, I'm not pledging and saying, all right, like I'm gonna do everything I can to make sure that our fraternity has the most power, and I'm gonna do anything, including committing crimes, putting cases on people, killing people. You know, that's not what I'm swearing to do when I join Alpha Kappa.
Yeah.
But when I swear to become a bandito, I'm agreeing to, you know, to commit crimes.
So Sheriff Villanueva has said that he has done more than any other sheriff in Los Angeles to tackle this issue of...
He needs to put some respect on Jim McDonald's name.
I mean, I don't think that we're going to see that happen personally. He does not have a high opinion of his predecessor, Jim McDonald. I'm curious, though, like because the amended complaint actually accuses him of being part of allowing these gangs to perpetuate.
Yes.
I'm wondering if you can talk a bit about in what ways are the plaintiffs saying he does that?
So before he retired out, it's been communicated to me that he had no affiliation with any deputy gangs. He was looked at as kind of like a loser, a nerd. There's an interview with his now wife, Vivian, where she's very much rashing him, making fun of him for being like a Four Eyes and bifocals. He wasn't a well-liked guy. And although he did say at a Board of Supervisors meeting that we were all cavemen, it's been made clear to me that the cavemen were a clown in this guy. He was not one of them. When he ran for sheriff, he was elected, I think, largely because he was able to get the buy-in of the Democratic Party. But also, a lot of deputy gang members. There were many deputy gang members that served on his campaign the first go around. I think most notably Karen Mandoyan, who we know is an inked Grim Reaper. And before Villanueva was elected, he sent an email to the chief of staff of the prior sheriff saying, we need to get my boy back on staff with quickness, which was illegal.
Yeah.
And I think that right there is furthering a gang and doing something
absolutely
illegal.
And you're providing cover for deputy gang members who have been found with cause to be having done something that is mandating their termination.
Exactly.
And then you're overturning that, which gives a sign to all of the other deputies that you are going to be operating a more permissive culture. Now, I mean, the like you said, the banditos have 100 inked members. Does that make them... I know we know very little, and actually I feel like a lot of what we know is coming out of this particular case. Is this the largest gang that we know of? Are there more widespread ones?
So what I have been told and what I understand of the way deputy gangs work is that they will tattoo 1 through 100. Once they reach 100, that's it.
Okay.
And a new gang forms. Recently, the banditos had an inking party to blast out the remaining numbers to 100. And several people that were prospects, including the people that were allegedly prospects, I should say, including the people that killed Anthony Vargas, the people that killed Paul Rea, became members.
Chasing ink is the term that gets used.
Yeah. Yeah. So now they're members, and it's expected that there will be a new gang at the East LA station. It's been hypothesized that that was done in order to staunch these investigations and questions that are being asked about the Bandidos. The thought being that if they are no longer giving out Bandido Inc., the Bandidos are no longer a thing. They no longer exist. That isn't really great critical thinking right there, but that's what it's been communicated to me was the thought behind that. I'll also say that on the subject of Villanueva, you know, it's not just, you know, allowing people that were fired back in. He did that in a number of cases. There were many people that were let go with cause that he has taken a stand and said, we're bringing them back. There are Bandidos that work on his staff, most notably Danny Batanero, aka Batman, Manny Navarro. I don't know his gang name, but Manny, if you want to let me know that, I love using your cute little gang names. Both of them are on Villanueva's staff. They work as his personal security and driver. And one of them was actually just promoted to sergeant. So we saw stuff like this happening under Baca and Tanaka. You know, like, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, give you a promotion and a nice little pay bump. And, you know, it's happening again. It's very much in plain sight. Mr. Villanueva is not clever by saying that these are cliques and that he's done the most for deputy. I mean, maybe he has done the most for deputy gangs. He keeps promoting them and giving them pay bumps. Like, yeah.
Honestly, I'm still like just trying to process the notion that by finishing out a 100 inked members of the Bandidos that they think, and honestly, conceivably could be correct, that would be sufficient to have the county sweep this under the rug is really just a lot to take in, especially as, you know, we've heard so much in terms of the things that you've been reporting, Cerise, about the Bandidos in particular victimizing at will members of the East LA community. You mentioned Anthony Vargas, who was shot in the head, in the back of the head by Bandidos members or alleged Bandidos members. The chasing ink phenomenon of like in order to become a member of the Bandidos, you need to do something sufficiently vile to merit your inclusion in this group. And now we might have a new version of that established in the same station is a lot to process. How could this be rooted out of the sheriff's department when it seems like it is the entire composition of this department?
Yeah, I mean, my reporting shows that deputy gang membership goes all the way up to the top, and you know, as far as like
it is the roots,
it is the roots. I mean, it's the whole tree. I mean, I think a lot of people that I speak to in the department would agree with that most people in the department, you know, have an affiliation with these deputy gangs. I've spoken to multiple people in the department that said 90% of LASD employees are affiliated with deputy gangs in some way.
Wow.
Right, because if it's not Villanueva, it'll be someone else, because it's
Cecil
central
Rambo.
To it's central to what LASD is. Which is why abolition is the only answer.
We're going to keep following this story. I think that this particular case offers a, if not unique, at least it is coming at a crucial time in the history of law enforcement in this city. And so hopefully, I mean, this seems like the sort of thing where the county traditionally rolls over and settles for an enormous amount of money. But we are hopeful that maybe more details about the inner workings of the LA Sheriff's Department will be forced to come out, because the code of silence that seems to prevail and the code of violence or history and tradition of violence is something that you've covered really well. And with that, we want to thank everybody for listening today. This is episode 185. Thank you to my guest hosts, Rachel Reyes and Cerise Castle.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope you both come back. This has been so much fun talking to you. I could do this for hours. Thank you for listening. Brian Holmes, thank you for producing, and Matt Tinoco for editing. We will be back next week. Bye. Is it past?